you decided there were too many people and you didn't want to live someplace else. So what did you do when you quit the railroad?
Well, I was like a fish out of water, John. I looked at various things around our area, and finally, in desperation, I went down to a place here in town that sold industrial machinery. And I knew these people in the past through my association with them in this little town. And I was told by a man named Leighton Graham, he would hire me for an industrial machinery salesman. And he would furnish me a car, and I would sell industrial machinery to sawmills and other manufacturing places between Walla Walla and Baker, Enterprise, Pendleton, Hermiston. And all I had to do was just get in the car and go sell machinery. They already had an established route. And I decided I would take this job. It was kind of interesting, John, but it paid much less money. And I didn't really like sales as much as I thought I might. Anyway, I continued to work there regardless, because it was a job and my wife was working. So we were allowed to stay here in La Grande, and I even thought about selling cars, a hand Ford motor, and tried that for a short 2 or 3 weeks. This was unfortunate for me in a way. Maybe I would have found out, because I was so interested in Ford cars, that I might have made a career out of that. But one day, a man that I knew that come into industrial machinery says, "Wayne, I have a position for you here in this valley that pays good money if you're interested." He worked for Borden Chemical. And
not to interrupt you.
Oh,
there,
no.
But I was wondering if you might tell about your experience buying Boulder Park. Because that was when you first quit the railroad.
Yeah.
And
true story. Well, also I failed to mention that in 1964, on the railroad as a train dispatcher, we had 7 miles La Grande to Hillgard washed out by a terrible flood. And during that time, we could not run a train between La Grande and Hillgard or east and west. And I had worked trains, caterpillars, huge amounts of men, and I had to give them permission to operate where they could in that washed out area. A tremendous experience, the only known flood while I've been alive that actually washed out those railroad tracks. Another fascinating part of being a train dispatcher. But anyway, to go on with it, I quit, resigned from the railroad, and again was looking for things to do to supplement my wife working. So I had an opportunity through a local businessman who knew that I loved to hunt and fish and was pretty well experienced along those lines. I had an opportunity to go look at a trailhead on Main Eagle Creek in our Eagle Cap Wilderness, where there were facilities to stay overnight, cabins, little apartments, 54 head of horses, corrals, horses, hay, the whole thing. But the main idea was that this lodge called Boulder Park Lodge, that Betty could work there, I could work there, I could work as a guide and a horse wrangler and take men paid paid customers to go up Main Eagle Creek up to the top practically of the Eagle Cap Wilderness and down into the upper Minor River for some of the greatest elk hunting still left in America. The transportation was horse transportation, definitely different than me and the railroad and transportation, cars, horses, and trucks. I went back about 50 years and transported people on their horse or our horses with pack horses to bring in their equipment to set up camps in the high country all the way on Main Eagle and the upper Minor River and over Bench Canyon Pass, a pass that was 8,100 feet high. So you come to winter early in that country. Anyway, I convinced Betty that she could do this because she was such a good cook. Turned out that Betty fed many, many loggers, hunters, fishermen at the lodge where we had good equipment to do the cooking with and make beds and do that type of work while I done outside work, primarily gone most of the time in the mountains, setting up, taking down camps, bringing in the archery hunters game, showing the people where the elk and deer were in that country. And it was all very interesting to me, although I found out it was, for some reason, as much as I like to hunt, for personal reasons, I didn't get too much of a thrill out of showing these people, although they're paid customers. I felt like they should be able to get their game on their own. Well, that doesn't work in a place like that. You've got to show them where the game is, and it sometimes was requested to shoot their game. And these people had more money, John, than I could count. And they were from California and other places. And although I was waiting on them hand and foot. They couldn't ride the 25 miles into our main elk camp without being extremely stove up, some of them unable to do it. All kinds of physical problems, complaining about that we were in a wilderness area and would we ever get out of here if something happened, and all kinds of things of that nature. To be brief about it, I finally decided at the end of the season, and I went by the Thanksgiving, that, hey, you better take a look at this, not to mention that for the money I had invested, for Betty being pulled away from her job at the bank, the total economics of the situation was not good enough to stay.
And then the weather probably was the driest year that you could have picked in many years.
Yeah.
And they delayed the hunting season that you depended on.
John, you're right. Many things happen. It's a bad fire year, as John has mentioned. Our seasons were delayed. We lost customers, not because of us, but because of the state of Oregon and the United States government closing down certain areas.
Yeah.
And therefore, we weren't making any money. And it was extremely disappointing on that part of it. In the end of this operation, as much as I like the outdoors, great cooperation from my dear Betty, and my little children were very good, Mark and Kathy, and they helped me do chores. They cut wood, they kept the cabins wood supplied, they done all kinds of work. They rode horses, of course. It seemed like every other day we had a rodeo where a pack horse would jump and start dumping his shovels and tools on the ground, not because there was anything wrong, because some dog barked, a customer's dog barked, and the pack train decided to give it up. We also done work for the U.S. Forest Service on their trails. This was handy work. keeping the trails clear of trees and so forth. Then they wanted to restrict us on using chainsaws. That made that a considerably different
because
job.
Because it was wilderness area.
Wilderness area. There's new laws coming too. And John, it the overall picture there, and particularly I realized it was a young man's game. To be frank with you, John, you needed to be 30 years old, strong, very adept, loving horses. Something I found out, although I liked horses, I didn't have that love of horses as some men and women do.
Well, the only reason I brought it up is...
It's all right.
Circumstances happened way beyond your control in many times to make it just hard just to continue your business.
It was hard to do, and in the spring of the next year, I was offered, and I was happy. I was offered to get all the money I'd put into it out, and they formed a corporation, and I was taken out of the corporation, and my interest was returned to me. They're very fortunate on this. And another couple, plus Bob Goss, people that you know, were in it. And in the final end, the government purchased it. We were on government land, but we owned the property. And in the final end, John, now Boulder Park is simply a trailhead. There is no lodge. There is no cabins.
They burned it all.
That's right. And it's now is called a trailhead for Main Eagle Creek.
Well, it's one of your experiences that I thought would be well to tell about, because you know, you had an experience that so many people don't and have no way of knowing. Now, if you want to go back to say when you started to work for Borden Chemical.
Well, I on this Boulder Park high mountain pack, under no circumstances would Wayne have ever been allowed to find out if, in fact, as much as I love the outdoors, hunting and fishing, what I needed to find out for myself, and often thought about it, was to actually give it a try. Find out if that's the kind of life I wanted to spend the rest of my working days doing and career. And I found out, as much as I loved it all, it was for younger people, not to mention the bad things that happened, such as forest closed down and so forth, so forth. But the main thing was, I didn't really see where that type of life, to be a big game guide, was good enough. I found out something I needed to know, and so I left. But anyway, to go on with it, I come back, of course, here to La Grande, and I had this situation where I was offered a job at Borden Chemical. And I was not a pipe fitter, I was not an electrician, I was not skilled at any type of manufacturing. I went out to see the people in charge of Borden Chemical, and they had people down from Bellevue, Washington, where they interviewed me, and after they found out my name and so forth, what makes you think you want to have this job? I told the man in charge that I so loved this valley and I so wanted to stay here at a job that would be allow me to have normal wages and would allow me to stay here was what I was really interested in. No, I'm not a welder, I'm not a pipe fitter, I'm not an electrician, but I'm very willing to learn. And finally, the man said to me, you know, Wayne, because you worked 17 years, or whatever it was, for the Union Pacific, straight until they told you you're going to move to Omaha, I find a man like you, where you didn't jump from job to job to job to job, that you're the kind of people that I want to work here at Borden Chemical. You can learn, and you can become just as good an employee here as you were on the railroad, and it's a good job, Wayne. If you like it, sign here. And that's what happened to me. And it turned out that at Borden Chemical, I was allowed to work inside from the horrendous winters of our Grand Ronde Valley that John here knows about. But I did, in fact, work inside. I actually manufactured resin to be used in conjunction with the particle board plant next door. We supplied the resin, they supplied the chips, and particle board, of course, in our knowledge of woodwork and lumber and so forth, become very important in construction of furniture, houses, whatever.
How was this resin mixed?
It was mixed with several components. We were able to manufacture formaldehyde, the pure formaldehyde that is used for many, many things in industry, actually. And we used it plus agricultural urea that come in huge railroad hopper cars. It is usually used for fertilizer on soil. The mixture of formaldehyde, the mixture of this particular urea is called, plus menthol, caustic, all of these rather dangerous chemicals, phenol, extremely dangerous. This come to our plant in railroad tank cars. Anyway, while manufacturing the resins in huge reactors, you know, twice the size of this house, we manufactured and then shipped that resin underground to the particle board plant at LeGrand, not to mention truckloads of it to all over our Northwest. And then we made a resin, John, for plywood plants, Elgin, Emmett, Western Oregon, Missoula, various places. Here we use a combination of formaldehyde, menthol, caustic, and phenol. These are all dangerous chemicals, but they were enclosed primarily, other than when you loaded or unloaded a truck. Extremely dangerous. For example, if you had a 12-inch square, 12 by 12 by 12 by 12, fall on your chest, not protected with rubber protective clothing, you would die within 3 minutes. Therefore, we were all told, including Wayne, that when you're working unloading a truck, you have got to be heads up. You can't make mistakes. You must know which line it's going down. You must know that the valves are closed or unclosed, so forth, so forth. Funny part about this, John, my last 8 years, I was allowed to work outside as an outside man, loading and unloading trucks, but I got to work from 7 o'clock to 3, a daylight job. The first one I ever had, really, when I come down to it. And even a more funny thing, the year that I retired, 1990, we had had miserable winter, one right after another, drifted snow, 20 below zero. Everybody lives in this valley knew it happened, not to mention 50 mile an hour winds. And guess what? I told Betty when I wanted to retire, and she said, "You should do it, Wayne. Just think, you won't have to be out there in those winter storms." I said, "I'm going to do it, Betty." The man that took my place worked the next 8 years. We haven't had a bad winter since I quit in 1990. And they all told me, people that you know, by the way, said, isn't it funny, Wayne? You said you didn't want to work another winter out here, and we've had nothing but mild winters. And I know John knows that. Anyway, very pleasant life here.
Now there's some things that we kind of left out.
Okay.
When you were going to high school, you liked to hunt and fish. what was one of the first guns that you had?
Interesting that you bring that up, John. I come down here from the Kettle Falls area, Rice, Pleasant Valley, where we were on the Columbia River and we had short-range shooting. Of course, I was, at that time, unable, John, to buy expensive, nice hunting rifles. In fact, people at that time primarily either had a 1903 Springfield 30-06 from World War I, or more often, a 30-30 lever-action Winchester, some gun of that nature. But most important was, when I come down to Le Grand, I found out that the ranges were extremely long range as opposed to where I lived, where we had trees, swamps, creeks, heavy timber. And the range oftentimes would only be 30 to 80 or 90 yards. And the 32 Special 30-30 lever action Winchester were far the most popular in that country. And they did not need any rifle that shot 200 yards. Well, I come to this area of hunting, and I found out that most of my friends had 30-06 or other long-range rifles, 270s, various good rifles, and I found out that my 32 Special was still a good gun, but it was primarily a 100-yard gun. And it was bothering me that everybody else was shooting and on occasion killing something at 200 yards, such as an elk, such as a deer. Well, John, I finally got information from Grant Chandler, a gunsmith of renown in this valley, and he said, Wayne, your old 32 Special is a good gun. And I'd like you to know that I still believe him as a good gun. But he says, frankly, this country is a lot of open country. I suggest that you buy a 300 Holland and Holland Magnum rifle, and you'll never again have to purchase a long range anything. Well, I so admired Grant Chandler and some others that I purchased this gun. And for the first time in my life, I was up equal or better than most of my hunting companions as far as long-range rifles. And, God, as you know, John, I've got horns, cougars, bears, elk hides, elk horns. I even sold a set of deer horns at this house for $1,000 because it was a non-typical buck, and I couldn't believe someone would give me $1,000 when I've been selling horns from my garage for 35 cents a pound. And the man proved to me that he meant it. I called my boy at Baker, Oregon to find out if I should take it. They were beautiful horns. And Mark said, my gosh, Dad, take the money. Of course, our background, you could imagine. I sold those horns for $1,000. I still got them right in here. I got the $1,000 check, cancel check in here. Yes, I love to hunt.
How about your association with Walter Smoots?
One of the finest things that happened to Wayne while going to high school in Le Grand, there was this country boy named Walter Smoots who lived on our foothill road. He loved the outdoors, he had land, both mountain and flat ground, to hunt pheasants, to deer and elk upon the mountain. Was extremely interested in it. He found out that I loved to hunt also, and we became great friends. And his love of hunting, shooting, not to mention both of us being active in our LeGrand Pistol Club, LeGrand Rifle Club, participating in shooting sports, Walt and I can only say as we killed so many deer and elk over a great period of time, and it was such fun, and we looked so much forward to deer and elk hunting that there's no words to explain it. Walter once told me, before he passed away, unfortunately, that we, John Turner, Wayne Drummond, lived in the best of the last, where the United States is concerned.
You mentioned the LeGrand Pistol Club.
Yeah.
Where you belonged, and Walter belonged.
Yes.
Vernon mm-hmm. Carpenter. And
there was some other guys, yeah.
And, can you tell a little bit about when we competed once a week and where we shot? And,
well, yes, John. On the rifles, we fortunately here in LeGrand had a rifle range not too far out of town, 7 or 8 miles, 9 miles, and it was a good range, and we all participated out there that were interested in shooting in competition for turkey shoots, for hams, for just good comradeship. To some of the guys going to national meets clear back in the Midwest, not me, John, but Pistol Club here again with a place we fortunately were able to have a basement downtown LeGrand located in the I think it was the First National
Eagles.
Eagles, pardon me. You're right, John. The Eagles allowed us to use their facilities in a basement where we could in competition and fun shoot our pistols from .22 up to larger calibers if we so desired, and it was great comradeship. Everybody liked to, in this group of people, and there was quite a few of us, they loved to become and were proficient with shooting the pistol of various calibers, and just I think we were all certainly able to take care of. Someone asked us if we knew how to shoot a pistol. We sure as hell did. And not only to mention, not only some of us had concealed pistol permits from practically 1946 on, many of your friends and my friends, and we were adequate with these pistols and adequate with the rifles, and it was just fun. Some embarrassing things happened. My friends, John Turner, Vernon Carpenter, Merton Taylor, various ones of us who did a lot of things, including pheasant hunting and deer hunting and so forth. One of the things that happened in one of our local restaurants, my friend Walter Smoots had a large single-action Colt in his overcoat. It was loose in a pocket in the coat. At that time, four of us came into a little local restaurant. For some reason, when Walter took off his coat, the pistol clattered to the floor, scooted across the floor, and stopped. People looked down on the floor, looked at the pistol, looked back at Walter, and Vernon Carpenter was trying to shove himself underneath a table so he wouldn't be seen. He was too embarrassed, and Walter casually got up, walked over, picked up the pistol, shoved it back in his coat, and we went on to do our ordering for food. Vernon never did get over it. Another time, Walter Smoots, companion and friend that he was, one day we were riding horses, having a wonderful time. We weren't hunting, we were just up in the mountains helping his uncle get cows. But we were dirty, dusty, had horrible looking old cowboy hats on, dust falling off our coats, dust on our Levi's. We walked into the Green Parrot Grill.
That was in the Foley Hotel building.
Foley Hotel building, you're right, John. Anyway, at that time, here in our town, we had the Air Force cadets were attending college at our local college.
That was during the war.
And during the war, it was.
World War II.
World War II, sir. And funny thing about it was, in the case of Walter and Wayne, we simply wanted anything to drink, and iced tea would have been fine. We went in and sit on the little stools at this Green Parrot Grill, and sitting down on the stool, left and right of us was these Air Force. Sit down on the stools. Walter had a single-action Colt in a holster. I didn't have one in a holster, but he did. And it was easy to see. And a big cartridge belt. Anyway, Frank Rohan, for unknown reasons, come walking in the Green Parrot Grill. And he come up to our backside, exposed, and he slapped both of us very hard on the back with his hands. And the dust flew, the dirt fell off us. He said, "God damn it, cowboys, how you doing? It's about time we start doing something in this town and make it interesting." The cadets got up and left the Green Parrot Grill and was heard to say by one, by Walter, that "Let's get out of here. These goddamn drunken cowboys are going to hurt somebody." And they left. If Rohan would have not slapped us on the back, they'd have probably abided the fact that we were dirty and filthy and cowboy hats, but that done it. That had lots of words.
There's another time that a little incident happened with Frank Rohan up at Morgan Lake. Can you give us a little story of what happened that day?
Oh, John, I'm sorry, I don't recall it. I know that Frank and I and John and everybody went to Morgan Lake. I got pictures of all of us in a Model T Ford.
Well, that was later. The one that I'm talking about.
Go ahead, please.
The time that Frank Rohan was camped up there and somebody accidentally, or a bullet skipped off the lake and shot a mustard jar.
Well, now, John, that you bring that up, yes, Frank was camped in Morgan Lake. It was one of our rather favorite close-by places to duck hunt, goose hunt, and fish. And somehow or another, and I honestly don't recall, John, maybe you can help me. They got to shooting 22 rifles across Morgan Lake to other people in the cottonwood trees. They weren't shooting at the people, but they were skipping bullets off the lake.
We were trying to raise the ducks off the lake.
The object was.
Didn't realize what was happening.
Nicely said by John. There was a raft of ducks on the lake, and we could not get them into shooting range of our shotguns, where they would get up off the water, come around, and allowing us maybe to get a shot at the ducks. And I was told just the other day by Elry Thielen, it is a wonder that we didn't shoot somebody.
Well, I had a shotgun.
I know, John
I didn't
had
carry that far.
John had a good shotgun. I remember that. I think I had my 20-gauge single shot at that time.
Well, I bought mine with the money we made at the Pacific Food Express Company.
Very good.
Racing cars.
Oh, that was wasn't it a Model 12 pump Winchester?
Yes.
Excellent gun.
I still have it.
Yeah, I got one that you helped me to purchase in this very town from a manager of La Grande City, another Model 12, which I still have.
Yeah, well.
Wonderful 12-gauge shotgun. Yeah, let's see, John, I was thinking here, I wrote some notes, but they were mostly not particularly interesting. I was fortunate enough to have two children. I had a boy, Mark, and a girl named Kathy, and I have three great-grandchildren, and unfortunately, my boy died from a very bad accident on a log loader in which he lived four years, and finally in the end the injuries from that horrible wreck caused Mark to pass away. Let's see here. I think that's about it. I love to live here.
We didn't talk
valley.
Too much about our friend Merton and Richard
Taylor. I liked them really well.
It's,
what did Betty put down here? Married. Merton and Richard Taylor. I don't know how to say anything better than Richard and Merton Taylor lived out here in our valley. And at that time, when we were going to school, and they were going to school, and they had, during the Great War, 1942 to 1946, they had ability to get gasoline for their cars, and they always had nice cars, and they took John Wayne, Walter Vernon, many of our friends, every place there was, because they had gasoline and we didn't. They had money and we didn't. But they were so kind. So kind and good to us that I must say they were great friends and still are and still live in this valley. I'm sure, John, I'm leaving a lot out here.
We went to school with a great bunch of fellows and girls in the class of 1946, and
I felt we did.
We meet for lunch,
yeah,
at least once a month.
Gosh, yes.
And we're very fortunate to have such good friends.
Yes, and
after all these years,
and out of that group, a great group of people. Naturally, some of them passed away at this time, but we didn't have any crooks. We didn't have anybody in bad trouble over breaking the law, truly breaking the law. We were just a group of people that grew up during World War II, and were fortunate that the people were as good and are as good as they are. Lived in a great time we did not have. When John and I was going to high school, the closest thing to drugs that I knew about at all was they brought out a country western song called Cocaine Blues. That's the closest I ever got to cocaine. We didn't have that as a problem in our society. Yes, we had liquor, but somehow or another, liquor didn't seem to play as great a role, generally speaking, as they now make it out to be in our society. And that's all I'm going to say about that. That's the way I feel about it. Yeah. We're just lucky. Like those pictures show.
Well, you like to live in the Grand.
I love to live in the Grand. I don't know of any place, John. When I come into this valley from Pendleton, Oregon, Spokane, Washington, or coming out of Baker this way on US 30 or I-84 now,
I don't know of a prettier place. The way the mountains ring, the flat, large, flat valley. It's just a beautiful place. I remember a comment my boy made when he got out of, he was in the National Guard for 7 years, and he come out of Fort Sill, Oklahoma, landed in an airplane at Pendleton, Oregon. Got off the plane. We were all glad to see Mark. He was glad to see us. I said, well, what do you think about maybe living in another part of the United States now, Mark, that you've been around in the manner you have? He said, I don't ever want to go further south than Baker, further north than Pendleton, and further east than Enterprise. That's it for me. Well, that's kind of the way I have felt about living here when I got out of the Army, San Luis Obispo. I come north to San Francisco. I come up to Bend, Oregon. Every mile north, I felt better. And finally, I come into this valley, and here was going to be my home, and still is.
Well, when we were kids, you could go up Deal Canyon. It was probably the only one, but the people let us. We could walk across to Morgan Lake.
It was wonderful.
But today, everything is posted. And we understand in some ways why they have to be that way.
Yes.
But it's sad that the younger generation will never know the freedom that we did.
John, that's well said. Going up Deal Canyon here, right at our west end of our city of La Grande, and going up this mountain road and walking, most of the time we were walking, not driving in cars, and finally coming to Morgan Lake in a nice long hike where we could fish for trout, perch, whatever. And we did it often. It wasn't just once a year. We had the freedom to go on land that is now all privately owned with a lot of restrictions, not to mention the government has closed down many of the old trails and roads right out of our town. They're closed down to people, and it's true. Now, you're much more restricted. My father once told me, he said, someday, Wayne, this place that you call a national forest, you'll be so restricted you won't even be able to walk in it. And I'm sorry to say that it's fast approaching that. There's a fee for camping. There's a fee for everything you do that's outside of your town.
We used to just get in the car and go up and put up our tent along the Grand Mound River.
Oh, God, today, yes.
Today, you can't stay there, only in certain places. And like you say, there's a fee.
There's a fee. And John, on the great Grand Mound River, I'm glad you mentioned that, we had many older friends, John and I, that loved to fish and fly fish, and they could roll right out of our town, La Grande, go any part of the Grand Ronde River and catch trout. And they could go a long ways up the Grand Ronde River and catch trout. And at that time, if you had a fishing license, or was legal, we'll call it, you could catch 20 trout and bring them home for your day of fishing. Now, if you could find a fish, and with our recent salmon rehabilitation, we have a situation, they don't stock the stream, they don't stock Catherine Creek. These are little creeks that John and I used to go fishing in. Now, if you could, 5 fish is your limit. Even Willow Lake, you can only catch 5 trout for your legal limit.
Well,
it's changed.
When you and I were kids, there was pheasants all over the valley.
Oh, my God.
And brush along the Grand Mound River. And now, the Grand Mound River has disappeared in many places. And there isn't the pheasants.
And there is no cover, and there's no brush. And the Game Commission at one time used to raise wild birds close to Hot Lake. And now, several years ago, they decided we didn't need a pheasant farm in this valley. There was no cover for pheasants, no use to try and promote them, and there is no pheasants. It's changed entirely. Yeah. there are, even at that, there are still some places that I can still pursue the elk and the deer, but it's not as easy as it used to be. Every place there's a little road I used to travel on, they have a sign saying, no vehicles beyond this sign. And when you're old, it's hard to walk miles. And then if you did kill an animal, how do you get it out? They've changed the complexion of hunting and fishing. I still love it, but they've changed it.
Well, one of the funniest things happened is our last class reunion, when Jim Bennett said he almost got run over from an elk down on Washington between 4th and Depot Street.
That was
and
a true
Betty
story.
Come out and, by an elk, and here was a 6-point bull elk right there on the street in Le Grand.
And fortunately, a bunch of the class were able later and at that time get a glimpse of this large bull elk. Very unusual, John, to say the least. And John Turner, who lives right next to me, finds, as I do, in we happen to have a good part of land where our houses are located, and we have the deer on both John's property and Wayne's property, and this year the bucks were stripping off the bark of my quaking aspen and pussy willow bushes, and I was somewhat disgusted. So yes, we still have lots of game in this country. In this town, we have mule deer and whitetail, and as John mentioned earlier to me, Wayne, we even have cougars that come down into our land. This is true, although I personally haven't seen a cougar here in town.
Well, there's something that we have now that neither one of us have probably ever hunted. Have you? Turkeys?
Turkeys. Interesting, John, you bring turkeys up. I had a friend say just the other day, he is the same age as John and Wayne. He is over 70. He said, I'm not going to shoot one of those ugly, scraggly turkeys. I'm not going to go hunt them, Wayne. I said, well, according to all of our outdoor magazines, we should be hopped up by a special shotgun, camouflage clothes, and go out there and shoot a turkey. He said, not me. But I guess, as John was mentioning, we have a good population of turkeys in this area outside of our town and down towards Elgin and out towards Ladd Canyon. But I myself have not partake in that. I like to hunt blue and rough grouse. Maybe I'm too old to change my ways.
Well, you have a camper and a little boat that you carry on your trailer.
Still
where
got
are some of the places you like to go fishing?
Oh, yes, I'm fishing. Certainly that has been cut down considerably, once again, as we've mentioned here, outdoors. But I even still go up to Morgan Lake, short ways out of town, 2 or 3 miles, put the boat in the water with no electric motor, no outboard, and row and fish on occasion. Morgan Lake is just 2 miles from town. But I also, in the past, we had a great lake just outside of Baker called Mason Dam or Phillips Reservoir. And for years, John and I used to go over there and catch trout. And it was wonderful fishing. The fish were oftentimes 13 or 14 or bigger, inches long. That was one of my favorite places, John. That has been ruined by people putting trash fish in it, and the trash fish ruining the habitat for trout. And I do wish the Game Commission would correct that. However, I do take my little boat up to Grand Ron Lake, Anthony Lakes, again with no motors, row, still fish, or troll by using oars.
You go to Pilcher and to Wolf Creek, and you're both in Union County.
Yes, and I do. One of my favorite places is Pilcher here in our county. Thief Valley Dam, I got albums that just, you wouldn't believe the fish that won't fit in that sink there. Wonderful times with this simple 12-foot boat, simple 3-horsepower engine, and oars. Yes, and then I, of course, went to Willow Lake, further away, but I still went there. I haven't done as good as my friend John, who has gone oftentimes to the Snake River to fish, and I haven't done that. Many of my friends do that, and maybe I should get on down there.
Well, it isn't the distance that you go. It's
no.
The fun that you have just getting out of town.
Oh, yes.
In our own country.
Oh, John is so right on that subject. I was just noticing here, I had written this note here, back to our previous conversation, CTC, Felix Cavallo, my chief dispatcher, came to this train dispatcher's office and worked the first CTC. It was from La Grande to Huntington, and then, of course, up over the mountain. And he was a student of Pelton High School. I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
And him and Johnny Fair started here on train orders and then into CTC, which is that picture.
Then he went into the service and then came back.
That's correct.
After the war.
This is correct. You knew that.
Yes.
Yeah, very good. Felix was very helpful for Wayne in train dispatching. And in fact, he and Ben Johnson and old Jim McLaughlin, there's a picture of him, right here, I guess, but there is one of them. Phyllis McLaughlin, a classmate of ours, was another chief dispatcher. They're all extremely good.
Well, Felix's wife was an operator, and you have a picture in Rails and Derails there with your dad and her standing at the
Bowman Hotel
counter in Pendleton, Oregon.
Pendleton, Oregon.
Which is part of the Union Pacific.
Everybody involved. It certainly was.
It was either from Reef to Huntington.
Her name was Katie Gunn. G-U-N-N. She later became Katie Cavallo. There's Johnny Fair, the big tall guy. Anyway,
what a great bunch of people to work with.
Well, I had
no.
Another thing we failed to mention, John, the immense size and powerful steam engines that historically ran through La Grande and around La Grande, that when you stood on the depot, a huge building here still at La Grande, on a brick sidewalk, a large brick sidewalk, when one of those big steam engines come by, the building and the cement and the bricks all felt it. This is great.
They were like poetry in motion when the drivers would start.
And I'd like to mention that, John, one time while learning to be a train dispatcher, I had to learn where the sidings were and how you approach them, whether it was on a hill or on flat ground. And they called them, each individual train dispatcher had to take what they called a road trip to get familiar with what you were working with, not just what was on your CTC board, but the grade of the hill, how steep it was, so forth. But the interesting part, one day, an old engineer named Ed Ebell worked right out of La Grande here. His home country was over in the Huntington area. We got on a fast number 12 passenger train. Went out of La Grande at 4 p.m. every day going east towards Huntington and Boise. And he says, "What are you doing up here in the cab, kid?" He was in an 800 class, large, beautiful passenger engine. I said, "I'm supposed to take a road trip with you here, Ed." He says, "Well, you're going to get one." And before we got to Hot Lake, Oregon, from La Grande, on a huge speedometer, a John, that speedometer's this big, we were doing 102 miles an hour, and he put his hand down on my shoulder, and he says, "How you like that, kid?" Christ, I couldn't believe we were rolling like that, but I knew we couldn't outrun John and Wayne and his friends. We get in our best cars of our parents to go 80 miles an hour to see if we could keep up with the Streamliner or another passenger trains, and before we even got out to halfway across the valley, they ran away and left us. Buicks, Oldsmobiles, Cadillacs, Fords. They looked like that, man.
Did you have to take a rule car exam like the roadmen?
Oh, yes. Our examination as a train dispatcher, with the exception of the air brake system, got to be fair here, all the operating rules, we had to be, supposedly, we had to be better, if anything, than the engineer or conductor, because each engineer and each conductor, when we were train orders, he had to read legible, handwritten train orders, where to be, what time, so forth, so forth. And we had to know that that was right, John. And if this train order dispatcher put out an order that says, run extra from La Grande to Tallahassee, for example, and for some reason we forgot another train that had authority to run to Crooks between Tallahassee and La Grande, we could have a head-on collision. Mm-hmm. They were called lap orders. And if you had a lap order, you pretty near always killed somebody, not to mention the destruction of the trains and the fact you lost your job immediately.
Now, with the trainmen, they had to have job insurance. Is that the same thing with the dispatchers?
No, they did, as John said. They had a wonderful, strong operating union that protected their men, and insurance, as John just put it, we did not have that. In fact, if you made a mistake during dispatching, it just was over. And that was part of the stress, John, that the train dispatcher went through. He knew if he made a mistake that that was the end of his job. Not to mention people getting hurt, you know.
Or killed.
I had, occasions where I had a backing up a work train, and I told the man on the head end of the work train that it was okay to back at Tallahassee on the siding. They were spreading gravel, and it was okay to use the siding only and not get into the signal system, where in fact it would change the position of the signal or light. And a man named Charles Daffer lost a leg simply because, and he was a brakeman, but I give him authority to back up. Daffer wasn't ready, and when the train started to move, he fell off the end gondola, took off a leg. Had lots of terrible incidents of railroad wrecks in the town of Pendleton, striking cars, trucks. Oftentimes listening to the engineers say to me, "Wayne, this guy just drove right up on the tracks. We were blowing the whistle. It's a straightaway. He just drove up on the track anyway."
Well, that's the only time that you could blow a whistle in Pendleton when there's an emergency.
John's right. Could I get you a Coke or anything?
No.
Okay. A lot of things in train dispatch. We had a coal car, a heavily loaded coal car at the town of Huron. It was there for the section foreman. He used the coal in the winter to heat his place of living. For unknown reasons, on a given day, I was on as a train dispatcher working daylight shift, and I noticed suddenly there was an occupancy showing that there was something between Huron and a town called Duncan.
I called the chief dispatcher. It was Felix. I said, there's something wrong here, Felix. We got a train out here, but it's not a train. He said, maybe one of those trackmen has laid a steel bar across it. I said, yeah, that's right. All of a sudden, loudly on the phone, there was a section for him. He says, Wayne, is this Wayne? Is this Felix? Who is this? I said, well, this is Wayne, CWD. He says, CWD. That was their initials as train dispatchers. We had them, FHC for Caballo, for example. But anyway, he says, I've got a coal car. It's loose, and it's going downhill towards Gibbon. Duncan. I said, well, there's nobody on it. Is that right? He says, you got any trains coming? I said, no. As luck would have it, I didn't have anything coming out of Pendleton towards what we call Duncan. And I said, it's just running free. And he says, yeah, it'll derail. Eventually, it'll get high enough speed that it'll derail. I said, well, I don't know about that, but I'll take your word for it. But what would be a chance of getting a hold of the section man at Gibbon and have him take the switch in hand control and line it into a siding and into a Y, and it could tip over and not hurt nobody. We got a hold of pure miracle, got a hold of the section foreman down there at Gibbon, and he took the switch in hand control. I didn't have any trains. Had I had a train and a man would take it in hand control without permission, all the signals go red every place. But he had permission from me. That goddamn coal car, half loaded, it turned out, I didn't know. It went in there and went into the side and into the Y and tipped over. Never hurt a soul.
What, somebody released the brake or?
The only thing that the section foreman here Huron, he said the brake was set. I can't explain it, Wayne. All the rules were abided by, but that thing took off. There was nobody around it.
Yeah.
Maybe he took the responsibility. Maybe I didn't have that brake set tight enough. I asked him if he had any blocks on it, you know, things that you would ask. He said, no, I didn't. Anyway, there was an occasion where I had that coal car